In this session, David will share with you the practices that you can begin to engage in once you have committed to awakening to spiritual enlightenment. He describes the most effective forms of meditation and contemplation and cautions against being seduced by the supernatural. He will teach you what to follow, but maybe even more importantly, what to avoid. First, in this session, David addresses the question of following the benefits to traditional religious practices in seeking to uncover our enlightened state of consciousness, and if one has to give up their current traditional religious observance in order to uncover our enlightened state, and finally, how to receive the full benefits of meditation and contemplation.
You can stay with your traditional pathway, because it's, of course, a very valuable energy field to be in. And then what you want to do is deepen your understanding. So you can stay with your traditional pathway, except that you want to understand it from a deeper level and not just rote memorization, but comprehension experientially. So the meditative practice deepens your understanding of any religion, and so does contemplation. So what I usually emphasize is both meditation and aligning your life so that what I always say is what you try to do is make your life the prayer. You try to live and become that which you are studying and learning. So you become forgiving. So in the beginning, forgivingness seems like an artificial practice. Jesus Christ said, "Forgive them, they know not what they do." So that's sort of a mentalization. And when you're angry at somebody, it may cross your mind, well, I should probably be seeing it differently, but I don't. But as you get deeper in it, then you say, well, how can I see this through different eyes? How can I alter my experience of this? And then that requires a deeper study. So you're trying to go from the intellectual, familiarity of the intellectual, to the experiential. You're trying to become that which was formerly mental and now incorporated into your personality and your way of actually being in the world. You do this, I think, the most effective way. Of course, meditation has its place. Meditation, of course, has a great history, and we could spend a couple hours just describing all the meditative pathways, and I've experimented and tried them all. I belonged to the first Zen Institute in New York City back in the 50s, I guess it was. And I did Zen meditation for many years. For over 20 years, I meditated an hour in the morning and an hour in the afternoon. And you meditate on some specific truth that you've picked up until you really become the awareness of the truth and the reality of that. Then you don't need to artificially, mentally say, well, I should be forgiving the person. You see, eventually, that everybody is only being what they are, what they can be at the moment. Everybody is just being what they could be at the moment. And if not, it's because they can't be. If they were able to be different, they would be. So you have a certain sympathy for everyone, that everyone is pretty much stuck with the human condition. And the human condition is, frankly, extremely difficult. I think it's extremely difficult, the human condition, for the individual as well as whole societies and civilizations. The thing about meditation is it takes you away from the world. In other words, you've got to set aside an hour in the morning, an hour at night, in the afternoon, like I did. And a lot of people, what happens to do is they compartmentalize it. So when they're meditating, that's one thing, and then they go back into the world, and that's another thing. People do that with religion, of course, typically. On Sunday, they're very religious, and then Monday, they're back to the usual business, padding the bill as usual, see, but maybe feeling a little guilty about it, but it gets compartmentalized. So because it interferes with daily life, after a while, many people give up meditation. They're too busy this morning, they'll skip it, and then tomorrow it's too busy. And meditation then tends to get lost. Contemplation is a lifestyle of awareness, sharpened awareness. The nearest classic teaching of it is mindfulness. Mindfulness is to always be aware, to be consciously aware of what your mind is doing at all times, to not go unconscious and become oblivious to your own inner mental workings, to become familiar with the mind. By becoming familiar, the mind actually changes as you become more and more familiar with it. So a contemplative lifestyle is more effective. It's a way of being in the world because now you're trying to become that which you have studied. So contemplation, you can do that continuously. One can be contemplative no matter what they're doing. And so my own lifestyle was contemplative for many years to be aware of exactly how you are being with a specific incident. And that way you become more aware of the reality of other people as well. So you become aware of their reality. Get out of the solipsistic view that the reality is how you see it. I'm aware that there is a reality and this is the way I'm seeing it. This is not the way the world is. It's the way I'm seeing the world. So you get out of what's called solipsism, the idea that the world is the way you see it, which is sort of the downside of relativism as well, you see. If I see it this way, then that's the way it is, instead of saying, well, that's just the way I see it. A sudden understanding of that came relatively early in my life. There was a while I was on all kinds of big talk shows in New York City. So I'd go in from the country and go into New York City, you'd go up in some big building, you see. And you'd go on this program. So when you get up there, because you're the celebrity of the day, you know, everybody oohs and ahs, and they take you into the makeup and you get all made up, and everybody greets you. And those studios are huge. I think they're about a quarter an acre with the thousands of Klieg lights and stages. Anyway, you're the star of the moment, you see. And then suddenly you go on TV, and there you are, 70 million people are watching you, you see. And then when the show is over, it's funny, it's hysterical. All of a sudden, all the Klieg lights go out, hundreds of people disappear, and you can hear it almost like an echo. You're in this huge place all by your lonesome. Over in the corner, you can see a janitor maybe, and you can't figure how you get out of here. So I can remember finding a janitor and saying, how in the world do you get out of this place? So I got out of the place, and you go down in the elevator 35 floors or whatever it is, and there you are out on the street, and suddenly there's like a sinking feeling. Being on stage, 70 million people watching you, all these people focused on you as the star and celebrity, you're suddenly nothing. You're anonymous, and there you stand on the street with this peculiar crestfallen sinking feeling. And in that instant, I understood why rock stars and all these people do drugs, because when the show is over, you can't handle that going from that high to a crash to nothing. They have to keep it going with a party drugs, do some uppers or something to substitute for that, because you can imagine what it is for the great rock stars with 30,000 people cheering them, and then suddenly the Klieg lights go off and you're standing on the street by your lonesome next to the nearest deli. Completely anonymous, nobody. So I had a sympathy for them. I said, I can see why, yes, typically so many of them crashed later on, all the greatest names. And that crash is just, you cannot handle it. So they stayed high and then they died from that being high.